You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio, your voice in Spain. US consumption of avocados has increased dramatically in recent years. They are the fruit that everybody seems to want to eat, to get healthy. Nothing could be wrong with avocados. They're good for the planet. Or are they? The increase has become a boon to Mexican cartels who have extorted avocado farmers for money. Whilst the long-term solution to this problem requires serious reforms in Mexico, US consumers, in fact, consumers worldwide, can help advocate for change for avocado buyers. Falco Ernst is a senior analyst in Mexico at the International Crisis Group. They're based in Mexico. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Mexico City. Falco himself, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
The pleasure is all mine. This story, when it came across my desk, made me sit up and take notice. We seem to think that avocado is, I mean, not that we think any fruit is threatening, but avocado seems to be a healthy, great, green fruit.
It does have that image of the superfruit, of sort of like an innocent thing, of course, that does good to your body and that it wouldn't be able to do any harm, to produce any harm. But of course, I mean, we've seen that the story is a bit more complicated with any commodity, really, which is being hyped on a global level. There will be consequences on the production side. And this is something we've seen very clearly here in Mexico, which produces the bulk of the global avocado.
So why then is the avocado crop? Because we you know, unfortunately, when Mexico has come across our radar news-wise in the past five years or so, it tends to be something to do with drugs, you know, with the import of cocaine coming through into the US. So why do the cartels have an interest away from what you think would be a profitable business of cocaine into avocados?
So basically, it's just a juicy business for them. Mexican organized crime used to be mostly all about drugs exportation into the US, primarily also into Europe and Spain specifically. A lot of cocaine coming in through your ports there. And about drugs production on the local level, marijuana fields, heroin production, synthetic drugs, and so on and so forth. But because of the state's inability to actually create order and to curb impunity, to rein in the Mexican cartels, what they have been able to do is branch out into other commodities, into other types of territorial control. The business model has now become that you control and compete over a given territory. And once you control that, you get to actually squeeze out any locally available commodity or resource that has prominently included extortion and kidnapping against civilians, against even small-time businesses such as your local tortilla shop. But the big magnet in some regions has become agriculture. And in the region of Michoacán, which produces 90% of the avocados that go into the U.S., avocados have become such a juicy business because we're talking about a $1 billion market, and simply because of the fact that Mexican cartels have been able to branch out into this, extorting producers, farmers for income, selling them quote-unquote protection, but also kidnapping them, in some cases effectively expropriating orchards and production sites in order to become the bosses in the avocado business themselves. So we've seen a mutation of the way Mexican organized crime operates being symbolized by the superfruit avocado.
When you think about how this actually takes place, I mean, I think you've written before that you'll get a visit if I'm an avocado farmer somewhere in Mexico, you know, I'll get a visit from a group of men saying they're going to offer me protection, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. That's usually there's an escalation of violence or threat involved that you're faced with as a well-to-do businessman in that sector. So as you said, first of all, you will be sent a plainly clothed envoy by the cartel. Usually it's an accountant or somebody with that role who comes by, sits down with you, even buys you a cup of coffee and introduces you to the idea that it would be better for you to comply with an extortion demand with whoever is in charge in the given region. If you don't do that, then the threat will escalate to visits by armed crews by the given armed group. And then if you still don't play along, there's usually violence involved both against physical facilities, such as production sites and orchards and so on and so forth, but also against your employees, against yourself, and also against families, which is something we have seen over the past years in Mexico as well, that not only the diversification of business, of the business model of Mexican organized crime has mutated, but also the quality of violence, in the sense that families used to be off limits, but they're no longer off limits. So they use family members, wives, children, and so on and so forth as leverage to get what they want.
I mean, we're talking about violence. I was shocked to read about the events of last August. Was it Yurapan?
It's in Uruapan, yeah, exactly. So that was in the context of two groups competing over Uruapan, which is sort of like one of the main avocado hubs, but it's also a larger city. And in this sense, again, if you control that plaza, as they call it, that territory, you also get to monopolize local drug sales and extort other businesses and so on and so forth. So we have this competition between two larger groups. One is called the Viagras, a very telling name there, and the Jalisco Cartel New Generation, which is sort of like the new Mexican criminal powerhouse after the famous El Chapo has been extradited and tried in the United States. And they have been fighting it out about the control of the avocado region, basically. And what they did in that case was to apprehend, take 20, I think it was about 20 members of the opposing group, and basically kill them, part mutilate them, dump them on the streets, and hang, I think it was 8 bodies, if I'm not mistaken, from a bridge for everybody to see and for the public to be sent a message of who is really trying to be in charge.
Shocking, shocking indeed. It seems to talk of Mexico, and I talk to you and you're in Mexico City, but it seems that the police are powerless and not organized enough. There is perhaps an inbuilt level of corruption that has been institutionalized for the past 30 to 40 years in Mexico, and they aren't able to do anything about it.
Yeah, it's a mixture of factors, basically. So the fact is, after all, that Mexican law enforcement, Mexican security forces, and also the international community, which has been trying to churn out solutions, including the United States, but have been unable to curb impunity, i.e., the impunity rate for murder in Mexico sits above 90%, which means that there are very little incentives for you, if you're willing to do that, to not use severe violence, because there simply are no consequences, legal consequences at least, for you if you apply those means. And then on the other hand, as you already said, police forces are in over their head many times. They are paid poorly. They're equipped poorly. They're trained poorly. Some of the police officers have no training at all. So it's really a bit of an illusion that those kind of poorly equipped and trained and paid police forces would risk their lives by scoring up against a very well-equipped and very well-trained forces of the respective cartel. And then, of course, the boundaries between state and crime have been and remain to be very porous. Many times you cannot really tell a difference between the two sides, which means that you as a citizen really have no legal recourse. You have nobody to go to if you're being put under pressure, if you're being victimized in any way. And that remains the core issue that we need to tackle if we want to move along, basically. As I've said before in articles about avocados, is that, boycotting just that single commodity is not the solution, because it's not only about avocados. You can also look at other markets, including mining, logging, tourism, even the nightlife economy. You can look at berries, lime, papayas. They all have some type of influence and some kind of preying upon by criminal interests, basically. So we need to talk about more profound reforms, and that includes, above all, creating transparency into state security forces, so we can use that as a means to eventually curb corruption and collusion and provide Mexican citizens once again with a basic protection against any type of criminal interests that are situated within the state, but also outside of the state.
With the arrest of El Chapo, and it was, you know, huge news around the world, you know, the America's war on drugs, etc., the, you know, we've got our Mannix. Does that mean that the cartel, his call, is it the Sinaloa?
Sinaloa cartel.
Has that ceased to function, or has it had the, because they think, oh, we've lopped off the head of the cartel, or does the cartel keep going? Or with the incarceration of El Chapo, does that mean it's become much more dangerous because you have all these, I suppose when you've got one capo de capo, one jefe de jefes, it sort of looks after he's feared throughout the country, even by smaller cartels. But with him gone, every little cartel is going to take a bigger piece of the avocado, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Sinaloa cartel is not really involved in the avocado business specifically, but it is still an illusion that if you can take out a cartel leader, a capo, a famous one, such as El Chapo, that their criminal organization would just crumble away. Again, as I said before, you know, there's nothing to fill the gap in the sense that we don't have functional state institutions in those areas. So what happens is that other sub-bosses that were lower in the hierarchy than a guy like Chapo for a takeover, and sometimes, as you already alluded to, that does create internal divisions. That has happened quite a lot over the past years, actually, in Mexico, and that can increase violence as infighting often breaks out. In the case of the Sinaloa cartel, it's still being held together, but there are different factions, and there's a risk that a bit further down the line, we might see a fragmentation of the Sinaloa cartel as well, and thus higher level of violence. Just to underline that point, I mean, the U.S. in particular is still betting on the so-called kingpin strategy, which reckons that if you take out a criminal leader, then the organization will go away and you solve the problem. And that has wreaked havoc, really, in Mexico over the past 20 years almost now, in the sense that, for instance, in 2006, we started out with about six rather dominant cartels and controlling markets, controlling larger patches of territory. They went in hard with the military, with U.S. support and international support. And what happened is that the six original cartels have multiplied into literally hundreds of very localized, regionalized armed groups that fight it out amongst each other. And the state has simply been, as I said before, you know, either playing along, playing with them, playing the same game, or are simply in over the head. So we have drifted towards a true mosaic of regionalized armed conflicts in Mexico as a result of this misled policy.
And I suppose the other thing is the fact that if you look at how Mexico's history, for perhaps 70 years, Mexico was run by an authoritarian party, which, you know, okay, it wasn't democratic, but at least it kept the cartels in check. And now since was it 2000 that Felipe Calderón came to power? And now the democracy has made it much more difficult for these, as I said, it's much easier now for corruption to spread. And there's no incentive, if you like, for people to want to do something against this.
Yeah, that's pretty much correct, I think, and broad strokes, at least. So, I mean, we did have 69 years of one-party rule. The dominant theory is that they sort of, you know, governed effectively also into criminal markets and sort of kept violence at bay because they had the capacity to control top-down, as it were, basically, and to enforce that many times in illegal ways. Of course, we're talking about state narco pacts for decades. With democracy, you have a multiplication, a fragmentation of power within the state apparatus, basically. So different state actors were beginning to engage in their own parallel deals. And those arrangements between state and criminal colonial actors eventually entered in conflict with each other because no single state actor was able to actually establish the rules of the game, keep violence low, or enforce those deals because you simply didn't have a concentrated governance capacity anymore in this sense. The underlying issue is really that democracy in Mexico has been mostly electoral, in the sense that people do get to cast their votes, not always under free conditions either, because there is criminal interference. People are being forced to vote for certain people in the most tightly controlled regions by cartels. What happened is that you have the advent of electoral democracy in Mexico, but what didn't happen was a profound democratization into the regions and into the state's own institutions, in the sense that you still have a lot of leeway for criminal agendas to prosper within the state.
You're a senior analyst for Mexico with the International Crisis Group. Tell me a little bit about what that is and what they are doing. Are you advising? Are you just reporting? Are you just recording on the situation over there?
Right. So a crisis group has a very particular sort of operational model in the sense that we do applied field work. So I spent a lot of time in the field, particularly in the regions most affected by the type of conflict I just described. And we try to engage and talk to all conflict parties. For instance, over the last year, I've been spending a lot of time in the state of Guerrero in the south. There's also some avocado production there, but it's mostly about mining and heroin. And we talk to the heads of cartels, we talk to self-defense group leaders, and we talk to people trying to mediate, as well as to victims organizations. So we're trying to bring all of those voices together in order to then propose to decision makers and to the general public possibilities for mediating conflict and for ultimately moving towards peace. With our information, we provide reportage for a more popular audience, but we also, and this is our core business, produce policy reports, which we then pass on to decision makers at the international level, at the United Nations, the European Union, for instance, and at the domestic level in Mexico, in order to engage in discussions about what to do about the situation and how to garner international support for the solutions we provide.
I'm talking to you from a studio in Spain. Now, the links between Spain and Mexico obviously go back centuries. Spain is a very popular Mexico is a very popular destination for Spanish, and Mexico is becoming a very popular destination worldwide. And yet, away from, say, you know, from the Mayan coast, from Tulum, from Mexico City itself, then, does this having effect? Will this lawlessness, will this inbuilt corruption and the cartels, do you think it's going to have, if it has not already, have an effect on the growth of Mexico as a tourist destination, as an investment destination?
Well, so far we're not seeing that effect. I think this also has to do with this mosaic of conflicts and of different types of environments that you have in Mexico. Still, Mexico is a very large country, of course, and there's patches where the tourists go that are safer than most parts of the United States, for instance, or many parts of Europe in a sense, right? And so it's a very fragmented, very differentiated landscape in a sense. I think further down the line, it is indeed very much in the interest also of private economic interests, the international tourist industry, and so on and so forth, also the domestic tourist industry, to try to come to terms with the question of what they should and could maybe contribute to solutions in this sense, because it will eventually come back to them as well and affect their interests. So I think one of the things that we should appeal for is for the private sector to become more involved and to actually recognize that in the long term it is in their best interest to contribute to greater stability across Mexico.
I mean, if I want to do something on a more basic level, should I be boycotting the humble avocado, or how can we help what's going on in certain areas of Mexico at the moment?
Right. So there's unfortunately no short term, no easy fix to the situation. As I've mentioned before, boycotting the avocado wouldn't do any good because criminal operations, criminal interests would simply morph into a different form, move to other commodities, because also in other economic fields, there is nothing that keeps them from doing that, basically. And a boycott would pull out the rug from under thousands of hardworking families in regions such as Michoacán, for instance. So that's really not the solution. It could actually make things worse for locals and could see a further aggressiveness of criminal groups as they would make up for lost income, for instance, by preying on regular civilians and so on and so forth, as we've seen in other areas before. And now what we should do, what we need to do down the line is to try to ask the question of how the economic weight and the economic interest of the avocado can be translated into pressure for state reforms. And I think there we need to have a thorough discussion, including local entrepreneurs, including importers into Europe, into the United States, so on and so forth, of how the economic weight can be translated into pressure on Mexican authorities to take the necessary steps to move toward, above all, creating capable state institutions and curbing impunity. If so, we're talking about a long-term, process that we need to kickstart, essentially.
If people want to find out more information about the work that you do, presumably International Crisis Group has got a webpage. They can find you that way.
Yeah, absolutely. This is crisisgroup.org. We have a global presence, so I would appeal to everyone to actually look up reports in other regions as well. Work a lot in the Middle East, in Africa, for instance, as well, in other parts of Latin America. So all very fascinating insight accounts of what drives conflict and where solutions could come from. And of course, you will find all the publications on Mexico there, including policy reports, but also more popular format reportage, which include the voices of cartel hitmen I interviewed, cartel bosses, other types of political operators, and so on and so forth. So it does make for quite a catchy reading. It's all available there, and you're also very much welcome to follow me on Twitter under Falco, at Falco Ernst, I think it is. I mean, you'll find me there.
That's Falco with a K, isn't it, Falco?
Yes, that's true, yeah.
It's been a fascinating conversation, Falco. I'm not sure I will ever look at the humble guacamole in the same way ever again after this conversation. It's something that I think we should be made aware of. Falco Ernst, Senior Analyst for Mexico at the International Crisis Group. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.